Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, committed to conservation and careful management of the state's forests to make them more resilient and better habitats for wildlife. Choosewood.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha.
I'm actually a commercial seaplane pilot, which means if somebody was stupid enough, they could pay me money to fly them somewhere in a seaplane.
Did you have to alert certain people that you'd be landing or taking off in the Missouri River?
Sometimes it's land first and make excuses later. You're supposed to make every attempt to make sure that you have permission. But in a public river that anybody can drive a boat on, we can land a plane on it.
On April 6, 1924, the Royal Australian Air Force set out on a journey to circumnavigate the continent in a seaplane. That trip took 44 days. And on the 100th anniversary of the occasion, pilots in seaplanes will again circumnavigate mainland Australia. St. Louis resident Kathy Babbis will be one of them, and she seeks to become the first woman to accomplish that feat. For more, here's producer Alex Hoyer.
So take us back to 1924. Why is it that in 1924, the Royal Australian Air Force set out to circumnavigate the continent?
Number one, just to do it. But the second reason was to surveil the continent and see where they could build real airports for airplanes with wheels.
This was about 3 years before Charles Lindbergh's famous Atlantic solo flight in 1927 in the Spirit of St. Louis. But what was aviation like back in the 1920s?
Well, it was very dangerous. I mean, they were still learning how wings worked and how to modify things, and engines weren't reliable. It was a very dangerous thing to do back then. And there was a pilot, a co-pilot, and a mechanic that were on board. And as a matter of fact, during their journey, they had to stop for 10 days and wait for an engine to come by boat so they could install a new engine, because their engine failed while they were on the journey.
This is that original Australian.
The origin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a seaplane out of necessity because there weren't airports, is that right?
Precisely. There were no airports, not very many airports in Australia at that time.
So 100 years later, you are also going to attempt to circumnavigate Australia in a seaplane. How did you even become aware of the opportunity?
Well, I became a seaplane pilot in September of 2020, of course, during COVID. I love to travel. Travel was not impossible, but it was complicated. And I had always wanted to become a seaplane pilot. And I thought, what else can I do with my travel money? And then I got a postcard in the mail that said, get your seaplane rating here in St. Louis. Now, the reason I got the postcard is not because they sent it to everybody in St. Louis. They had a list of pilots in St. Louis, and everybody got a postcard. And I thought, well, isn't this a nice coincidence? Called them up, and a month later, I was in seaplane training.
Training to be a seaplane pilot is not necessarily one of the first things that I would think of in terms of aviation in St. Louis. Was it a pretty rare opportunity to be able to even train in a seaplane in the St. Louis area?
It is. As a matter of fact, that business isn't operating here in St. Louis anymore. They had two locations, one in Florida and one up here in St. Louis. And the St. Louis airplane was only here during the nice weather, because nobody wants to jump out of the plane into the cold Missouri River and drag it up onto a beach. You want to only fly a seaplane when it's nice weather. And that's just a few months here in St. Louis.
So before we talk about how you trained for your seaplane license, let's take a step back. You've had a long career in the aviation industry. You became a pilot first in 1970. You've been a flight instructor, a ground instructor, and an air traffic controller. What made you fall in love with aviation?
That's an easy question. I grew up on an airport. My father had a business putting navigation and communication radios into airplanes. That's called avionics. And that was actually the name of his business. It was at Lunkin Airport in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was even my Girl Scout cookie route. I would put the Girl Scout cookies in a little red wagon, literally, and drag it around the airport. And who can resist a little girl with her red wagon full of Girl Scout cookies?
So what is it about flight then? So you grew up with aviation, but then how did it, were you in the air as a child, or how did it become then that it became more than a childhood interest of just liking to fly?
Well, number one, I was around the airport, and when my dad would go up to test fly to see if a certain radio worked correctly, I would go with him. Our family flew places, only parts of our family at a time, because I'm one of seven children. And several of my siblings also are in the aviation industry. And I even have a nephew who's a Air Force F-22 Raptor pilot. Oh. So aviation runs deep. Not all my brothers and sisters, but a lot of us are very interested in aviation. But when I was 13, I was in the eighth grade, and a friend that was sitting in front of me in class, I was talking about the airport, and she said, "Say, I belong to this organization called Civil Air Patrol, and it's about airplanes. Would you like to come to a meeting with me?" And Civil Air Patrol is the civilian auxiliary of the United States Air Force. We wore Air Force uniforms, learned military customs and courtesy. And Civil Air Patrol has the primary responsibility for ground search and rescue in the continental United States. You'll hear about all these other organizations that are out searching for a downed aircraft or stranded hikers. It's not just aviation. And Civil Air Patrol controls everybody else. They're kind of a behind-the-scenes actor, and sometimes they're right up front and obvious. But through there, every time you got a rank in Civil Air Patrol, like, you know, airman first class, you had to pass an exam on a particular aspect of aviation, communications, navigation, how an engine works. And by the end of that, you were ready to take your written exam to be a private pilot. I went through that program, and then I earned a scholarship to solo, and that was in 1970 when I began flying, and I earned a 15-hour scholarship, and the total cost was $301, and that included the airplane, the pilot, the instructor, and the fuel, everything, for 15 hours, so that's $20 an hour.
You can't get that now, can you?
Oh, no way, no way. And then the next year, I was eligible to apply for a scholarship to finish my license, and I successfully completed and got that. And they flew 22 of us to Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And we flew twice a day and once on Sunday until all 21 of us from all over the United States had gained our private pilot licenses. So that's my actual start in flying.
How did you wind up in St. Louis?
I came here for a job. In 1998, I was hired by, at that time, it was called the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. It's now called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. They switched names, I think, about 2003 or 2004 to that name.
Now, I know that there are some people who can't really talk about what they do at NGA. Can you talk about what you did?
Yes, I absolutely can, because while many things and occupations at NGA are classified, mine was not. We made what are called DOD flip. If there are any military pilots listening, it's the maps and charts that you use to fly when you fly on instruments. We made the en route charts and the instrument approach plates. And actually, for 3 years, I was the worldwide program manager for that program.
And when did you retire?
I retired in 2018.
So you talked about how you became aware of this company that was training to get your seaplane license. The company, unfortunately, is no longer in business in St. Louis. You got this postcard in the mail. How did it work?
Well, it's only a two-person airplane. And actually, the cockpit is, if you can imagine, the front of a Corvette. That's how much room you have in the cockpit of this airplane. And I just called them up. And then I met the instructor at the airport, and we had some ground training first because there's some special considerations when it's a seaplane, especially because when you're on the water, you're a boat, and you need to know all the boat rules And when you're flying, you're an airplane, and you need to know all the airplane rules and the special things about how seaplanes are different from land planes.
So the St. Charles Airport is where you would take off and land, and then there was the Missouri River is right there. Now, if I were driving along or on a hike and I saw a plane going into the river, I would think something was wrong because I would not think that there was that there would be seaplanes flying in Missouri. Did you have to alert certain people that you'd be landing or taking off in the Missouri River?
No, but there are rules. Like if there's a private lake that you want to land on, you're supposed to seek the permission of the owner of the property. There are some places like nature preserves that you're not allowed to land at. And, you know, sometimes it's land first and make excuses later, but you're supposed to make every attempt to make sure that you have permission. But in a public river that anybody can drive a boat on, we can land a plane on it.
Did you ever encounter situations where there were just concerned citizens that thought that something was wrong and they perhaps called 911 and there was some kind of response, or did that not happen?
That didn't happen because they can see us coming down. You know, if they're near the river and they see us coming down, we very obviously don't have any wheels sticking out because they're up on the struts and we look very boat-like. The hull of the airplane has a very boat-like look. And they just watch us and we go down, and it's, we usually do a splash and dash. So we're going to land, make a lot of splash, you know, settle down into the water, come back up, take off. And then it's obvious that we're not in distress.
That's St. Louis resident and pilot Kathy Babis talking with producer Alex Hoyer. Babis and her co-pilot David Greers will begin circumnavigating Australia this Saturday. We'll have more of their conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. Let's return to producer Alex Hoyer's conversation with Kathy Babis. Babis is a St. Louis resident and longtime pilot. And this Saturday, she will begin a 60-day journey that, upon completion, will make her the first woman to circumnavigate mainland Australia in a seaplane. Here's Alex.
I saw a map, and it had Australia superimposed over the continental United States. And they're close to the same size. So that kind of gives some context of the distance that we're talking about when you will circumnavigate Australia. There will be two crews doing the circumnavigating of the continent. One is going clockwise, and the other will be going counterclockwise. You will be traveling clockwise around Australia. Why?
I want to just address your whole question. First, yes, the Australian continent, the mainland continent, is just 1,000 miles less around than the U.S. continent. And we are actually taking off from Brisbane on March 30th, Easter Saturday. And we are joining the celebration on April the 6th, which takes off from Point Cook, and which is in Victoria near Melbourne. And one airplane, Michael Smith's airplane, and if you've paid any attention at all, he did in 2015, he did a worldwide, all the way around the world tour in the same kind of airplane that I'm going to be flying in. And he's very famous. Now he has a twin engine seaplane called a Sea Bear. And he is going, what they say in Australia, anti-clockwise.
Instead of counterclockwise.
Yes, they say anti-clockwise. And then about four or five airplanes are taking off from the same place, also on April 6th, all together, and we're going clockwise. And the reason is the first journey 100 years ago, we have their notes and their journals. Almost every single day, they had horrible weather. Mm. They were flying under the clouds. They were worried they were going to hit little outjuts in the ocean. It was terrible weather. And my flying partner, David Gears, and it's his airplane that we're flying in together. He did this same trip in 2014 for the 90th anniversary. And so he knows pretty much what we're going to face.
What will be different about the actual flying when you're going clockwise or counterclockwise? I'm thinking of wind patterns, for example.
The wind patterns will generally be a little more favorable because our planes only go about 85 to 90 knots. And so that's not very fast. And as a matter of fact, in our frequently asked questions on our website, someone asked us that question. And sometimes we might go up to 1,500 feet. Most of the time we're going to be flying between 500 and 1,000 feet. But if we're encountering headwinds there, a lot of times if there's a headwind lower, if you go higher, you get a tailwind. And so we'll be watching the weather forecast. Of course, weather forecasting has come leaps and bounds since 1924. And that might be the reason they went anti-clockwise, is they just didn't have the weather data and information to understand that clockwise would have probably been a wiser choice for them the first time.
What's different about a regular plane versus a seaplane? You've described it a little bit. And so the seaplane will have landing gear and wheels, but when those are not in use, they're kind of flipped up so that the plane just looks like a boat hull. And of course, it's different to land on a runway than it is on water. How challenging is it to land on water?
It's very challenging to land on water. Now, there are two kinds of seaplanes, the hull type, which is like a boat, which is what I'm flying. And then you've seen those ones whenever you see, like, things in Alaska. They look like they're on an airplane on stilts.
Yeah, and at the end of this, like the water skis almost?
Yeah, those are called float planes.
Oh, okay.
But it's the same license. Technically, I could get into one of those and fly it. Realistically, I should not even think about that until I get some training. Mm. And vice versa, them coming into this kind of plane that I fly. What is important to understand is if a seaplane's nose is too low, or the kind of water skis, if they're up on floats, it's the same principle. If they're somehow pointed in the water, and the airplane can flip, and it's extremely dangerous, and survival is not assured. Mm-hmm. So the landing is the most critical part. Taking off is important, but the landing part is the most critical part, because if you've got the nose too low or the skis too low, it can be completely disastrous.
You talked about the person who you'll be flying with. His name is David Gears. It's his plane. He's done this trip before to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the Royal Australian Air Force's 1924 circumnavigation. Your trip will take, I think it's 60 days?
We're estimating 60 days. We have 51 flying days scheduled where we fly at least part of the day.
60 days is a lot of time to spend with one person. And you've talked a little bit about the plane and its size. How do you know that you can put up with this guy for 60 days?
Well, that is the big question. we started with Facebook messaging because I found this opportunity on a seaplane pilot's Facebook page. That's where David posted it. And we started with just a few emails back and forth. And then he said, how about a Zoom call? And we started talking. And, you know, in one of the emails, I kind of said I gave him my aviation credentials and that I'm actually a commercial seaplane pilot, which means if somebody was stupid enough, they could pay me money to fly them somewhere in a seaplane, but probably I wouldn't be doing that. I also said some things to him in my first communication after he said, tell me more about yourself. I said, well, you know, I don't snore. You know, I've been in the Army, so, you know, I'll sleep in a sleeping bag, under the plane, on a hangar floor, in a dog bed. Okay, not really in a dog bed. You know, I told him I don't get hangry. You know, I don't care whether there's a lot of food or not. It's, you know, I said I have a nice sense of humor. And, you know, and we just kind of went back and forth. And over the months, this was in July last year when we started connecting, and over the months, we just get along great. And I also am very chit-chatty with his wife, Cheryl, who is not going along. She's been on several long adventures. She didn't go on the last one 10 years ago, but she does go with him almost every weekend. They seem to be flying someplace close by just to enjoy their seaplane and their friends.
We've mentioned before in this conversation that you would be the first woman to circumnavigate Australia in a seaplane, but that wasn't what attracted you to this journey. You just came to realize that there had never been a woman to do this before. And since then, I know that encouraging women in STEM fields has become a cause of yours. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, STEM education has always been a cause of mine. It's not a new thing. As a matter of fact, I volunteer at Wings of Hope in their Soar into STEM program, which is starting this session on the same day that we're taking off. We're taking off from Brisbane on March 30th, and the Soar into STEM program at Wings of Hope, which I usually am a mentor, so all 4 weeks on Saturdays of that program, I'm there. I'm assigned to a few kids who are mine, and we have a chat session at the end of each session, as well as I teach the navigation and communication portion of the it's like an aviation camp. It introduces the kids to all careers, not just pilot, drone flying, mechanics, doing electronics, being a bush pilot, all those sorts of things are addressed in the Soar into STEM program.
And you first got your pilot license, as we mentioned, in 1970. How has women in aviation changed since then, now in more than 50 years?
Well, it is, I will say it's better now, but when I started learning to fly, and I actually got my certificate in 71 because you can't get it until you're 17.
Okay.
So in 1970, I soloed. In 1971, I got my pilot certificate. But at that time, about 5 or 6% of all the people who held pilot's licenses in the United States were female. And now it's up to about 8%. But if you look at airline captain, female airline captains, that's still a miserable 2%.
So why you volunteer at Wings of Hope is to encourage young girls that aviation can be a career for them.
Girls and people in diverse occupations, actually African Americans, are even more underrepresented than females. The average, I think the percent is 3%. So it's even worse for the diverse population. So, and the key is exposure, getting them out to an airport, getting them to a STEM class, landing in your airplane, and you see a kid by the fence, and you go over and you talk to them, and you ask them if they, you know, want to come over and look at your plane. Do they want to climb in it? And, you know, there's a squadron out at Spirit of St. Louis Airport called the Red Tail Squadron. And it's formed out of respect for the Tuskegee Airmen, and they run classes through getting kids their licenses. It's a constant rotation. I think they're on class 13 now. So, and, you know, I will support anybody. I never charge any money to do it. You know, I'm just happy to go speak to schools or help in any way. As a matter of fact, when I get back in June, there's going to be an aviation class at DeChain High School, and I'm going to do my navigation and communication and mentoring for them.
What do you think will be the most challenging thing about this trip when you circumnavigate Australia?
The most challenging thing for David and I is finding reasonable accommodations, because that's going to be our biggest expense. Kind of fuel prices. Their fuel prices are like $1.75 a liter. So that's $7 or $8 a gallon for fuel.
And it's special fuel. It's not just the fuel you put in a car, is that right?
It is the fuel you put in a car. These engines are Rotax engines, and they prefer unleaded 95 octane or better autofuel. And we have to carry, some airports have this because there's a lot of airplanes that use this type of engine, but not every. So we have to carry empty fuel bladders in our plane, and then we have to find a way to get to, it's not called a gas station. Gas is what comes out of your body. If you say gas, they giggle in Australia. So you have to say, go to the petrol station, and we have to either walk there and drag those bladders back, or we have to somehow cajole somebody at the airport to give us a ride to fill our fuel bladders and come back and fill the tanks. So finding fuel, especially in the more remote areas of Western Australia, is a challenge. And we may have to fly for just 1 hour and land and get a little gas and fly for another hour and get more. You know, we have to really manage our fuel. That is a big challenge. But accommodations is the other one, because we can't make reservations too far in advance because we're at the will and whim of weather.
Sure.
And or a maintenance issue. Mm-hmm. So we if we make a non-refundable reservation, it's not good because we'll lose our money. So we are trying very hard to be home hosted. Mm-hmm. And we have had several offers. And for those places, even if we initially weren't planning to land there, we are altering our plans to allow ourselves to receive the gift of a homestay.
One of the things you're also doing is that you're, as part of this trip, raising awareness around suicide prevention. What is that effort?
Well, the name of the organization that we are mutually supporting, they're supporting us and promoting them, us on their website, and we're promoting them, is called Roses in the Ocean. And this charity in Australia is actually supported by the Australian government, is the premiered lived suicide support organization. And what lived suicide is anybody who's alive who's ever been touched by suicide, whether you have an attempt, whether you are someone who is thinking about it, or whether you are someone who has been affected by the loss of someone to suicide. And the reason this organization was started, it was started by the mother of the equivalent of a U.S. Top Gun pilot, and he also was a commercial airline pilot, and he took his own life, and his mother was just trying to make sense of it. She connected with David in his business, and
this is the person you'll be flying with.
Right, mm-hmm. David. And they started talking, and she brought it up, and all of a sudden, we are supporting each other.
Kathy Babbas, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Kathy Babbas is a St. Louis resident and longtime pilot. She spoke with producer Alex Hoyer. This Saturday, Babbas will depart from Brisbane, Australia, on a 60-day journey to circumnavigate the continent in a seaplane. In doing so, she would become the first woman to accomplish that feat. The journey marks the 100th anniversary of the Royal Australian Air Force's similar circumnavigation of the continent. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Just three numbers, 988.
This episode was produced, recorded, and edited by executive producer Alex Hoyer.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
If you listen to St. Louis on the Air on Google Podcasts, you may have heard that Google will soon discontinue their podcasting app. So we want to encourage you to find our show in other places. You can listen on the St. Louis Public Radio app. We're also on platforms like Apple, Spotify, and wherever you can get podcasts. It doesn't matter where you find your favorite St. Louis Public Radio shows, just that you do. Thanks for listening.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association. Missouri produces wood pallets, railroad ties, white oak barrels, hardwood floors, and more. Details on the variety of products made in the state are at choosewood.com.